KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Daly City.
Glenmore in Fremont.
East Bay, El Cerrito.
West Oakland.
Coming up, local teenagers connect for the first time to their parents' homeland through protest.
Throughout this revolution that's been happening, a lot of us have been saying, no, look, we are Sudanese people. We stand with the people of Sudan.
Then we'll hear about a Berkeley coffee shop dedicated to helping resettle refugees.
We always thought that we would bring people in with coffee and then foster conversations around refugees. And it's actually been the opposite of that. More the support of refugees are what drawing people in.
And from San Quentin Radio, a story about a prison chef who turns chow hall meals into magic.
You know, when it comes to any type of food, institutional food, is that you had to cook with your heart.
We've got an international flavor today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. Hundreds of people from up and down the West Coast gathered Saturday at San Francisco's Civic Center Plaza for a solidarity march for Sudan. For the past 3 months, Sudanese people in the Bay Area, like our usual host Hana, have been glued to their phones and tablets following the news from back home. People have been taking to the streets there to call for an end to the 30-year rule of President Omar al-Bashir. The internet's been buzzing with videos of the protests, but also of the brutal crackdown the government's been unleashing on the protesters. Amnesty International estimates more than 45 people dead, 180 injured, and thousands arrested so far. Sudanese immigrants in the U.S. have been organizing solidarity protests, including right here in San Francisco. And we're noticing a new generation of Sudanese American youth are engaging politically for the first time. Hana has more.
Late last month, about 24 people gathered in Hayward for a community forum about what's going on back in Sudan. Now, usually speakers and the people who attend these events are adults, and they'd usually be speaking Arabic. But today's event is different.
If they want to speak in English, it's okay. And if they want to speak in Arabic, that is okay. Ahlan.
Tonight, the adults are handing over the mic to some younger speakers, like 16-year-old Haifa Abu Sheba.
My generation, our generation, or the generation that's going to change Sudan. Mm-hmm. We're going to be the generation that's going to write the new constitution. We're going to be the generation that's going to bring democracy into Sudan. And I genuinely feel...
She slips in and out of English and Arabic and back, talking Arabizi, a kind of teen speak.
In the future, maybe not when I'm not aish, maybe when I'm not alive, but there's going to be a point in Sudan when Mara hatamsik Sudan, and she's going to lead to...
She's saying she's sure there will one day be a woman leading Sudan. Haifa is a senior in high school. Her parents drove 40 miles from Tracy to this event. And for her, the Sudan activism was sparked by the videos that started showing up on social media late December. Families worldwide, including mine, have been glued to Facebook and WhatsApp following the uprising on our screens. These grainy videos of protesters marching and chanting, in many cases being chased down by security trucks, hauled onto them, sometimes beaten, or worse, shot down. Haifa says she was amazed that after all that, people would still take to the streets the next day. She was so excited, she started showing her school friends at Tracy High.
And it literally, I would grab my phone, I'd be like 8 o'clock in the morning, run to my friends, like, look what my people do, and it's in Arabic, and they're like, what are they even saying? And I like explain to them. That made me feel like this is my home, these are my people, and I should be proud of them. I should never, they walk the streets and they ask for freedom and they fear nothing.
Now, this is a generation, many of whose parents migrated in the first place to flee the al-Bashir regime. Their homes are filled with patriotic music these days and excitement at the protests, but also disgust and anxiety about the brutal government crackdown. And the kids, they're watching, they're learning, and they're listening to everything. And for teens like Haifa, something else is happening. It's changing the way they relate to Sudan and how they identify here in the U.S.
I feel like after this revolution, yes. I feel like before that, a lot of them had the same sense as me, as there's nothing to brag about or there's nothing to say about Sudan. So we just like claim other things. We'll claim like, oh, I'm just black or I'm just African American. But I feel like throughout this revolution that's been happening, a lot of us have been saying, no, like, we are Sudanese people. We stand with the people of Sudan and we're coming out of our shells. And this is, I feel like my generation is bringing attention that you can be Sudanese and you can be prideful of that. That sense of your people wanting freedom just makes you prideful. And I just never felt that much pride before until now.
At the San Francisco City Hall solidarity protest last month, dozens of people waved flags and chanted slogans against the Sudanese government in Arabic and English. Kids were decked out in flag colors, holding signs they painted themselves. The speakers were all adults until somebody thought to pass the loudspeaker to Haifa. And she took them by surprise.
They're 30 years old when they should be at school reading books because the government doesn't want to give them money. A government doesn't want to support the educational system.
Her generation is witnessing its first popular uprising.
They want to park in the money for their own. They say that they're doing something for us, but I see people our age where they can be doing so much.
They've heard stories about the Sudanese revolting against military rule in 1964 and 85, but those are old nostalgic family stories. Today, these American-raised kids are on the Insta, Snapchat, and Twitter, following hashtags like Sudan Revolts and Sudan Uprising, and making protest art and music.
Tear gas and burnt tires here. Digging in your flesh, bullets from the liars here. You put your fist in the air.
While there's a lot of excitement about the uprising, it's also resulted in another reality that hit some Sudanese families in the U.S. hard. We're in the home of sisters Ala and Seja Hussein in Union City. Their mom Fatma's making the evening tea. It's only 7 o'clock, but they're yawning because they're jet-lagged.
Baba said he wants tea.
They just flew back from Sudan 3 days ago. Their parents had sent them to college there. A lot of Sudanese expats do that. And then the protests began. Seja says their mom started calling every day.
I would try to make my mom not nervous and not scared. So I'd be like, oh, mom, there's nothing, you know? But like, all of a sudden you hear tra tra. So the background noise wasn't helping me at all.
Their college mates went on a solidarity strike. And to them, striking was important because,
you know, there's people dying. There's people that don't have, you know, money to eat, money to live. There's so many problems that are going on in Sudan right now that makes it seem like we're ignorant if we were to just go to school and complete our education because, you know, we're known as the rich students.
And their college made headlines when it was swarmed by government security agents chasing down student strikers. They tear gassed the classrooms and beat the students. And it was all caught by a weeping student on a viral video. That is when Seja and Ala's parents had enough. Seja had just finished her second year when their parents started to plan for their departure. Watching the college attack video, Fatma says she couldn't believe her eyes. Her daughters were safe, but the college wasn't any longer. And she says it was clear to her that the college could have stopped the attack, but didn't. She says, I'm angry. We sent our children to our country, to our home, thinking they'd be safe, to learn their culture and be with family. Sadly, they had to come back home now. Back home to Union City, where they're applying to go to school in Dubai. And they're not the only ones. Many of their friends left, too. And Ala says it was hard to leave.
I mean, sometimes, you know, I say I really, really want to go back and protest and just be a part of it. Because at some point, this is going to be, you know, our Independence Day. And it's going to be our getting out of the regime and getting from under the tyrant. And this is going to be a big day when it happens. So I do want to be a part of it. But at the same time, like when I go on social media and I see videos, I'm scared to go back.
My name is Shabazz.
Shabazz is from the peninsula, and that's not his real name. We're protecting his identity because for this 18-year-old, it's no more just about videos. It's hit home. His mother, an American citizen, was caught up in a protest in Sudan last month. She was arrested, and he fears media coverage might jeopardize her safety, so he's using a pseudonym. I met up with him in a shop in San Bruno.
So when you first heard that, what were you feeling? What were you thinking?
Nervousness, excitement, anxiety, but also a lot of pride. Like, it's hella inspirational.
And he says it's made him look deeper at his connection to Sudan and his family.
We grew up in America, so we've become Americanized, and there's this disconnect between generations culturally and, there's this generation gap. And I think we're bridging that through this, like, revolution.
And remember Haifa Abu Sheba, who took the mic at the protest? She says now she gets why her parents get emotional when they talk about Sudan or when they hear 80s protest songs like this one performed live by singer Amala Noor. This was at a concert Haifa went to in Hayward with her family. For her, this uprising,
with this happening, it made me feel like I belong somewhere. And it's just this feeling of comfort. I feel like no matter what, I have a Sudanese community that has my back. I have Sudanese people that have my back. This uprising just makes me feel more comfortable and more belonging within myself and within my country.
That story was reported and produced by Hana Baba. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. Many immigrants come to the Bay Area as refugees, and those who resettle here have to secure jobs quickly in order to make their rent. It can be difficult with a limited resume and references. To help bridge this gap, a coffee company in Berkeley is providing job training and employment to refugees and asylees one cup at a time. It's the brainchild of co-founders Rachel Tabor and Doug Hewitt. And the mission of the cafe is more than just providing employment to refugees. It's about educating the entire community by offering a space where people can meet and share stories. In a story we originally aired in 2017, KALW's Jeremy Ju has more.
For here to go?
To go.
You want a room for tea? $4.
Nazira Bobery moves around the 1951 coffee shop with ease. Mixing, steaming, grinding coffee, whipping up espressos and almond milk lattes like a pro. But the truth is, she's new to this. And not so long ago, she was in a very different place.
You know, my last job was with United Nations as a communication consultant.
Before that, she worked as a journalist in Afghanistan, her home country. There, she had everything.
I had home, family, friend, job, career, everything, but I was not safe.
Her husband felt threatened because of his job. And so last year, even though she really didn't want to, they left. On December 5th, Bobery arrived in San Francisco. She became one of nearly 4,000 special immigrant visa holders resettled in California in 2016. And even as an experienced traveler, with an apartment waiting for her in the Bay Area, she still had a really hard time adjusting.
You know, for 1 month, I really struggled a lot.
She worried about friends and family back home, felt childlike in her inability to communicate. And the isolation, stress, and helplessness wore on her. She didn't leave her house.
You know, staying at home 24 hours is the most difficult thing. For 2 weeks, I just got sick. I just cried, that's it, I want to do something.
So she reached out to the International Rescue Committee and told them exactly what she needed.
See, if you really want to do something for me, I need a job.
And then someone there connected her to where she's working right now, a coffee company in Berkeley with a mission to employ refugees.
When refugees first come in, one of the most crucial pieces is helping them find a job.
That's Doug Hewitt. He and Rachel Tabor founded 1951 Coffee Company after working at the International Rescue Committee.
The U.S. government expects for them to be economically self-sufficient within about 6 months of arrival. And so finding that job as soon as possible is critical.
This means shortly after arriving, a refugee is expected to pay their rent, repay their plane ticket, and find a job quickly. And it is this urgency, Rachel Tabor explains, that really limits their employment opportunities.
Regardless of someone's background, be it they were a lawyer, a doctor, a farmer, a teacher, an accountant, it doesn't matter what role they played in their home country, they will find an entry-level position when they arrive.
So Tabor and Hewitt brainstormed ways they could help refugees find jobs, and the coffee industry kept coming up. The positions are forward-facing, so newcomers can work on their English. Plus, Oakland is one of the nation's major coffee ports, where tons of unroasted green coffee beans are stored.
And San Francisco and Oakland are the first and third respective highest-paying barista incomes in the country.
So they founded the 1951 Coffee Company. Hewitt says they named it after the year the United Nations first defined the guidelines for the protection of refugees.
We saw that as a very inspirational moment historically, and we want to be a part of that protection and that ongoing, you know, building process for them.
They initially launched a training program to get as many refugees into the coffee industry as possible. Then they opened their own cafe, the 1951 Coffee Shop.
We have 10 baristas from 7 different countries. That represents 7 different refugee communities that are here in the Bay Area.
And Nazira Bobery is one of them. And right now, she's mixing up a cappuccino with her colleague, Meg Karki, a refugee from Bhutan. Their shared experience as refugees creates a sense of support.
We feel like a family because we don't have family here. But we make a new family here, like if everyone just take care of each other.
And that's evident in the way they interact. As they prep an iced latte, around them sit customers of all different ages, all different backgrounds, sipping on their lattes, engaged in conversation, learning about the challenges that refugees face through the infographics that decorate the walls. Here's Tabor again.
We'd always thought that we would bring people in with coffee and then hopefully foster conversations around refugees and the support, and it's actually been the opposite of that. More the support of refugees are what drawing people in.
And Bobery and the other baristas see that, and it makes them feel good.
Some of them want to know, where are you from? They want to know about the stories, about the situation. And at least they give a comment that life gonna be okay, don't worry. These comments make us happy.
That's not to say Bobery feels completely at home now, or isn't sometimes frustrated with what she's had to leave behind. But compared to 3 months ago, she's in a better place.
16-ounce chai latte.
Happy that she is back to work and hopeful for the future. For Cross Currents, I'm Jeremy Ju.
Jeremy made that story in 2017 when he was part of KALW's Audio Academy. We're currently accepting applications for next year's class. Check it out at kalw.org. And that's also where you could find out about training programs 1951 Coffee is offering later this month. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. We're going to end today's show with a story from our friends at San Quentin Radio.
San Quentin Radio, bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden you heard this.
Some prisoners say food in a prison's chow hall is tasteless and bland, but it's not always the case, especially when John Parrott, also known as Yaya's cooking. He has the ability to make prison food taste like it's been home-cooked. It's why many fellow prisoners have dubbed him the unofficial chef of San Quentin. Here's San Quentin radio reporter Tommy Shakur Ross with a story produced inside the prison walls.
You know, the food was seasoned like I would expect if I was on the outside eating somewhere.
Typically, Yaya's meals have a southern twang to them.
the seasoning isn't just on the surface of the chicken, like on the skin, on the outside, but I mean, it's down inside the chicken.
There's sweet and sour. There's brown sugar. You know, these flavors, the flavor of molasses.
That's Darren Williams and Juan Haynes. The delicious meals that they're referring to was cooked by an incarcerated person named John Parrott, also known as Yaya. He's been preparing meals for annual religious and self-help group banquets in San Quentin for close to 7 years now. To hear Yaya talk about it, cooking prison food is all about a good attitude and a prayerful spirit.
You know, when it comes to any type of food, institutional food, is that you have to cook with your heart. If you go to the kitchen in the morning and they wake you up and you're upset and you're mad because you didn't get a good night's sleep, that's how the food's going to taste. If you're in a good, joyful spirit and you're prayed up, the food will taste good.
Yaya's been locked up for 23 years. He's 64 years old with cocoa brown skin and a warm smile. He discovered his passion for food and cooking long before ever coming to prison. Yaya grew up in Redding, California, watching his kinfolks cook.
My mother always had a big old thing going on in the neighborhood where, you know, it was just my sister and I and my dad, and she would cook for a family of four or five, but the pot would be filled all up and we can, you know, really feed 24, 25, 26 people.
Today, Yaya cooks for hundreds of prisoners who sometimes discard their share of prison food. According to Juan Haynes, that's something he does regularly when he goes to the prison's chow hall.
A lot of the meats I won't eat because they're just simply not prepared. It's like it came right out of the refrigerator onto our plates, you know, so I don't eat it. I'll give it away or I'll throw it away.
Darren Williams shares a similar sentiment.
For me, a meal in the chow hall is bland and almost colorless on most nights. And me personally, I have to bring my own seasoning with me. Seasoning, salt, some type of Goya or something, sriracha, hot sauce or something, just to make the meal taste like something that I can put on my palate and digest. You know, some of the stuff, I don't have seasoning on it, I might not even eat it, you know.
But when Yaya cooks, most people demolish their food and usually want more.
Okay, so plates are clean relatively quickly, and people are asking for seconds, and that's the atmosphere inside of the banquets.
I see guys that are willing to take anything off your plate that you're not eating. I see guys that will, if they can get seconds, they're getting seconds. Guys that are trying to take something back because they want this meal to last more than just in this event. So I'll see guys, when they can, they'll try to bag it and take it out with them, you know. And so I'm eating everything I got there, so I don't have anything for anybody else.
Before coming to San Quentin, Yaya has done time at Folsom, Pleasant Valley, Susanville, and Mule Creek. At each of these California prisons, he has found work inside the kitchen by volunteering or recommendations from others.
Well, you know, the word of mouth gets around, and a lot of guys you've done time with before know you cook, and they put your name out there, and one day you get a lucky break and you're able to go into the kitchen, and it speaks for itself.
Yaya says he enjoys cooking for banquets because it gives him an opportunity to spruce up meals with different spices, seasonings, and vegetables like onions and bell peppers, something that can't be done with the everyday prison meals.
Well, when you do institutional style cooking, you have to be real careful because you have a big setting. You had 3,000, 4,000 people here you cook for. Everybody can eat hot food. Everybody can eat salts. So you basically have a bland type of meal you have to put out. But when you do these banquets, I go in and, you know, I try to throw the kitchen sink in there to make the taste, like I said, close to home.
In preparation, Yaya likens himself to a football player who directs the offensive plays in the kitchen.
So if you got a group, say like 350 people, it's like a quarterback. Everything is on your shoulder. You got to make sure, number one, the accountability is good. Make sure everybody gets fed, you know. If you got three or four people there to assist you and help you with it, you got to make sure everybody has good conduct and character and integrity. It can't be any stealing, any shortcuts, you know, because everything's going to come back on me. And I got to make sure the play's right. I got to make sure the greens are right, the chicken right, macaroni and cheese are right.
You know, once I throw some salt in there, I can't make sure nobody comes behind me and throw more salt and ruin the meal. So that's what I mean by being a quarterback. You got to be held accountable.
As a banquet chef, Yaya makes a variety of meals, from barbecue chicken, hot links and burritos, to hamburgers, roast beef, and mac and cheese. But he also makes an effort to ensure that no one is left out.
Then you have to kind of ask that coordinator how many people you have that are vegetarians, because they don't, how many people don't eat meat, how many people don't allergic to peanut butter, how many people allergic to onions. So it's a whole lot of work to go in these banquets, and you just have to kind of make side dishes to accommodate everybody.
What it boils down to is that Yaya finds pleasure in cooking for others.
I like to see a smile on people's faces, you know, when I cook. It lets me feel good. I never look for any credit in anything because, you know, I do it from my heart. I don't ever want nobody to say, oh, man, that chicken was too salty. Oh, it wasn't cooked good. I try to put my best effort forward. So when I see people, you know, enjoy it, that really makes me feel good.
From both Darren and Juan's perspectives, Yaya experiences more than just pleasure. The way they see it, it's all about love.
He takes a lot of pride in seeing people satisfied and rubbing their bellies after a good meal. I think what gives Yaya the best satisfaction is the fact that he's able to serve others, particularly through breaking bread. He loves cooking.
To me, he brings a good attitude to things. He's always kind of jovial, good-natured, always got a smile. He has some humor for individuals. And I think that comes out in his food and his cooking. You know what I'm saying? Because for me, it's like he puts a lot of care and time into it. He's not just serving somebody something to eat just because, like, it's a job or something to him. But he puts some love into the food to me.
The chef of San Quentin, providing fellow prisoners with a taste of freedom. I'm Tommy Shakur Ross with San Quentin Radio. I'm out.
San Quentin Radio is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability. All content is approved by an information officer. Listen to more stories from inside California's prisons at our website, kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents newsletter, so you stay informed about news and culture from all around the Bay Area. This music is by Allison Harris, who lives in Blucher Valley near Sebastopol. She'll be playing Thursday night at Mystic Theater and Music Hall in Petaluma. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Treffney.